managers to come in or to prolong the life of all those things that are spoiling or whatever. It wouldn't have worked, but it's good for the extra advantage. During the strike, Social Alternative members in Boston, Worcester, Grafton, Amherst, and Holyoke in Massachusetts, as well as Providence, Rhode Island, and Norwich, Connecticut, were active on picket lines at a number of stores. And this was really welcomed. A lot of community support, political support was welcomed. At the end, as the strike went on, and the cops got more vicious in some places, they were able to turn some union bureaucrats against community support to a certain extent. Like in one place, towards the end of the strike, they separated out community supporters from the strikers, which was a really horrible, stupid thing to do. Can you be any more ignorant as a union leader than to like actually try to turn away community support by your actions or by siding with some cop making up some law out of his butt that's got nothing to do with anything, and backing that over the supporters that have come out there voluntarily, given food and water, and they're there to help picket and so on. And also, this article gets into many workers wish that the union leadership had done more pre-strike organizing preparation for the strike. Initially, most workers suspected for the strike till only last 1 or 2 days, 3 at most, but the strike lasted 11 days. As soon as the strike started, the company decided to anyway, I've already mentioned some of that stuff. For most workers, it was their first time going on strike. The last Stop and Shop strike was in 1988. It only lasted 4 hours. So a lot of the workers had never been on a picket line before. And there's this whole thing in this article I'm going to touch on, building effective picket lines and stopping delivery trucks and so on. But first, we're going to take a little break, give our legal ID here, speaking of legalities. We are WMFO in Medford. That's WMFO in Medford. Tufts Freeform Community-Based, I'm sorry, Freeform Commercial-Free, I like to say, Community-Based Radio Station, emanating from Tufts University. And we are a small slice of that community base. We are Socialist Alternative Radio. And we are here every other Sunday, 11 a.m. to 1 p.m. And we're going to take a quick musical interlude here and be right back with more about the Stop and Shop strike. Thanks for tuning in and stay tuned.
Age of Reason! all those great stories and ones about serial killers.
The dreams flow into savage toy.
Hear the siren screaming out across the city. We had three odd nights in succession. The riot season is here again.
Dear Lord, lead us back to the valley of the shadow of death. Yeah! Here comes the war! Ah, here comes the war!
So did you think we were born in peaceful times? The world in Derby spinning around. On the age of reason.
Oh, mama, mama, look there. Your children are playing in the street again. Don't you know what happened down there? A youth of 14 got shot down there. The cocaine guns jammed downtown. The killing clowns, the blood money men. Shooting those Washington bullets again. As every cell in Chile will tell of the tortured men. Remember Allende and the days before the army came. Please remember Victor Jara in the Santiago Stadium. Es verdad, those Washington bullets again. And in the Bay of Pigs in 1961, Havana for the Playboy and the Cuban Sun. For Castro is the color is a redder than red. Those Washington bullets want Castro dead. For Castro is the color, the bullet is a spray of lead. Moscow bullets missed. Ask him what he thinks of voting communist. Ask the Dalai Lama in the hills of Tibet. How many monks did the Chinese get in a war-torn swamp? Stop any mercenary and check the British bullets in his armory. Thank you.
was Sandinista by The Clash from way back in 19... When did that come out? 87, I think. Just off the top of my head, I'll say 87. Before that was New Model Army with Here Comes the War. New Model Army is still producing music, as far as I know. And they are... often played on our show because I just remember seeing them one time and it was a really good show, and that was a album they have called The Original 20, New Model Army Original 20, and that's a very political album, very very sharp album politically, I think, and from a progressive, you know, I don't know if they're socialist or not, but it sounds like a socialist inspired album, let's say. And you are listening to Socialist Alternative Radio here on WMFO 91.5 FM. And we are part of the community base here at Tufts Freeform, commercial-free, community-based radio, also known as Tufts Educational Radio. We have many names. And this is Socialist Alternative Radio, talk and music from a working-class, democratic, socialist perspective. We're here every other week, 11 a.m. to 1 p.m. Check us out on Facebook, Socialist Alternative Radio. We put a lot of, we share a lot of content. Put some little bits of original content on our Facebook page, and you might enjoy it. We're getting a lot of, I don't know, I'm not, you know, that familiar with Facebook technology in the sense, in the deeper sense of the word, but we're getting a lot of, I get these updates, right, because I moderate the page, and the number of people, what's the word they use, engaging with it or something, keeps increasing. And we have gotten some very nice messages from international listeners to this program, Socialist Alternative Radio, and people that also interacted with the website, I'm sorry, with the Facebook page. Back to the sort of aftermath analysis of the recent Stop and Shop strike, which is a very important strike, widely seen as a victory for the workers. We think it was a victory. But you know, we're not afraid to look at some of the downsides as well. That my basic take on it is they had this big multinational company on the run, and they ended the strike too early. I mean, there are a lot of pressures on the union on any time you're on strike, but they still ended a little too early, and could have actually gotten more. But they did well, relatively speaking, defended a lot of the benefits they had. Now the problem with the benefits, wages and benefits of Stop and Shop is there's this divide between part-time workers and full-time workers. So as a result, there's a minority of the Stop and Shop workers are full-time workers, and the company's always trying to limit that number. And the union's pushing back on that. I think they might have even gotten some language on that. But basically, the boss's glove, the Boston Globe quoted someone named Eddie Reese of Roslindale, a retired social worker who's got a high union consciousness, as you'll see in a moment. Reese supported the strike, did not cross the picket line, of course. And then she said, I don't know if that's a man or a woman, it's spelled E-D-Y, I'm assuming it's a woman. Reese wishes, I'm quoting the article here, still Reese wishes the contract were better. Yeah, it's a woman, it turns out. I'm disappointed that new hires are not getting a thing, the old divide and conquer mentality, end quote, she said, referring to the fact that, Boston Globe puts its own spin on that, saying that, their spin on it's okay in a way. They're redefining what she said as there'll be less unity in the union if all the workers don't get the same wages and benefits, or more or less the same wages and benefits. And then Eddie, they quote her again saying, we here in the 99% have to stick together. By the way, if you know anyone who's a social worker, I've known many social workers, they do usually excellent work and get very low pay. It's one of those things like daycare workers. You're sitting here wondering, you know, if you're still on the fence about capitalism, just ask yourself, why do people that take care of children, why do people that take care of the people that are having trouble in society, social workers, why do these types of jobs get paid so little? It's absurd. Do I want a CEO making $1 billion a year, whatever the heck they're up to now, and a daycare worker, you know, whether for children or for the elderly, to be making minimum wage or barely above minimum wage? I mean, this is complete inverse of reality to me. In a social society, hopefully there wouldn't be any wages eventually, but you would, you know, if you're still, if you're not at the point yet where everyone's contributing, what they can, and understood that, you know, society's functioning really well without any coercive aspect to labor. But if you're still like sort of dividing up who's contributing what to society in a future social society, if one ever exists, you'd be like, you wouldn't be putting someone that, you know, even a representative of you know, that has to make decisions and so on, hopefully with a democratic check of the people, you wouldn't be compensating them, whatever the compensation might be, them as much as you would someone that has lives in their hands, you know, nurses, social workers, daycare workers, you know, combination of capitalist exploitation driving down wages like they're always trying to do, coupled with a patriarchy that's built into capitalism from its foundations historically. And it's just, it's absurd, you know. I'm going to be mad about that all day now. Just thinking about that. And I, you know, when I first graduated from college and was unemployed and looking for work and so on and taking any garbagey job I could, my girlfriend at the time was doing daycare jobs, and the hours and the energy it takes, it's just phenomenal. And I've sent my kids to daycare, and it's just this underfunded thing in the United States, this thing that's just totally, like, I don't know, is it because, you know, what is it, less than half the population is having children now or something like that, or getting married, and then lower percentage having children or something, and millennials you hear about having to wait, which is perfectly understandable, unfortunate if they don't want that, but really unfortunate, a real evil in fact, but understandable that if you don't make enough money, you can't buy a house and even rent a decent place to have children in and so on. You know, it's really, things are getting really backwards, really topsy-turvy in the United States under capitalism. I mean, you can't, and elsewhere too. I mean, there's people making more money now than entire sections of the population put together. And when you're an individual making that much money, which is basically money made from stealing it from the wages, the unpaid wages of the working class, you can't spend it all. You just can't spend it all. And yet they're always trying to make more and more. And it's a question that a lot of workers just ask naturally. Say, you know, how come it's never enough for them? You know, when do they decide that's it? I don't need any more because I can live 3 lifetimes or 10 lifetimes or 20 lifetimes very, very, very comfortably with the amount of money I now have. Why can't I just stop? Why can't they just stop, you know? And most of them don't. They don't. You know, they want to continue to own what should be socially owned. You know, the private ownership of the social means of production and distribution of goods and services is the big inherent flaw of capitalism. And it creates incredible suffering and incredibly distorted lives. You know, like I was listening to this show on the radio where someone did a little TED Talk or something. These TED Talk things are really pissing me off, but that's another subject. But a TED Talk thing about we need to be in better connection with all sentient life on the planet, human and animal. And if you do so, you have less mental. If we did so, we'd have less mental health problems. Sorry. And all sorts of other problems, you know, and you know, of course, a lot of people, especially socialists, are saying, no kidding. I mean, you're acting like this is something new. But what I want to get at was empirical studies coming out where everything from exposure to nature to how many social connections you have, and also on the negative side, how alienated Americans are from each other, and especially when they get older, from not having any connections, social connections. It's just mind-boggling how what we take as normal behavior here is incredibly strange behavior for humans in other situations. And the person that was giving the TED Talk was from Africa, and they were saying that, well, you know, in Africa, there's still a lot more communal living in the sense of not living on communes or something, but, you know, like sharing of the way he put it, sharing of joy, sharing of sorrow, sharing of food, sharing of things that you have, and so on. You know, and I'm not trying to create some sort of like African tribal societies or post tribal societies. They're still living in kinship groups or whatever. That's like some sort of utopian or something, but I'm just saying, relatively speaking, and that's probably being worked on and changed and destroyed even as we speak, but I'm just saying that, like, that the way that we, the U.S. society has evolved or devolved under capitalism is quite absurdly dangerous and wrong. You know, it's just, people need social connection. They need a lot of things that just aren't part of living under capitalism. And what's the material basis for old people being treated the way they are under capitalism, and the way children are? I mean, I just gave these examples of, like, well, you know, work related to taking care of children, terribly undervalued under capitalism, right? Not much money put into that. Terribly low pay. A lot of profits made from it, but you can make profits of, you know, hauling garbage to, or, you know, owning garbage hauling things. I mean, that's not the point. And the it's what they put money into, what they allow money to go into, what other societies have put money into that are more influenced by socialist movements and socialist parties and so on. And you have, and with older people, although capitalism is trying hard to get rid of, in the United States at least, get rid of retirement and work people to death, literally, it's still a situation where a lot of older people are not seen as valuable by capitalism, consciously or unconsciously, because they can't be exploited as much as younger people, because they physically can't do as much in many cases, not all cases, but in many cases, and they can't, and they're just not as valuable to the capitalist as a younger worker, and sometimes older workers just won't put up with the same crap a younger worker will put up with in a job. Anyway, let's just jump back without even a segue this time. Just some stuff I need to get out. But the overall picture here is unions. The micro picture here is the Stop and Shop strike and its aftermath. Now, a couple of things that happened you might not have heard about during the strike that you'd only know if you were close to it is that this is, I'm going to quote a little bit more from this article by Alon Axelbank from socialistworld.net, also on socialistalternative.org. Some very basics about picket line stuff. If you've never been on strike before, there's this thing called a picket line. What's a picket line? A picket line is a group of workers that are usually moving like in a circle, or maybe they're just standing in a line, and they're trying to prevent other workers from, if that's happening, from scabbing, from taking work, from crossing a picket line, from trying to break the union, or customers, if it's a service thing, from going in. Buying something from the store that would help. And you're doing it all to stop production and profits being extracted from the labor of workers and so on, to stop the company, to show the company who's got the power, and to show the company how serious the situation is, and that you want to get an agreement, or you want the union recognized, whatever you're going on strike for. There's been all kinds of different picket lines. There have been like a strike that we talk about a lot on the show, the 1934 Minneapolis Teamster strike, which was one of three huge strikes that year that kind of started, that kind of built the CIO, the sort of more progressive wing of the labor movement for a while in the 1930s and 40s. And they had roving pickets in the Minneapolis Teamster strike in 1934, meaning it was a trucker strike. It was a coal and some other workers, with truckers and coal shovelers and haulers in Minneapolis in 1934, and to effectively shut down scab operations. It turned into a general strike where you shut down everything except for what the unions wanted and allowed to go in and out of the city. You didn't have enough people to like cover all the roads and everything, and all the railroad tracks and everything. So you had to do roving pickets where people literally loaded on the workers got on the back of trucks and in cars and stuff, and just drove around and set up pickets where they needed to, or set up roadblocks and whatever. And so in this case, because the Stop and Shop workers, many of them having not been on strike, they didn't really understand immediately what was going on. The union leaders didn't give a big lead in many cases. So some of the basic discussions about why you have a picket line, why you keep it moving, why you talk to customers and ask them not to go in, and even having chants on a picket line, why that's important to keep up energy. I'm paraphrasing a lot from this article here from Elon Exelbank, as I mentioned. And that did happen in a lot of stores. Maybe not to the full extent it could have, but happened enough that company was losing $2 million a day. Also, union truck drivers and the Teamsters Union pledged not to cross picket lines or make deliveries. Now, the company then hired or had non-union scab truck drivers, but some of those drivers were turned around. Convincing truck drivers not to make their deliveries was a crucial part of, making the company learn where value is really created. And that took the form of physically blocking trucks, of talking to drivers, convincing they should turn around. Some of that was successful, some of it wasn't. But even just a few successes, or more than a few, are really important in that. And there was actually in Jamaica Plain in Boston, a truck was turned around, and it made the workers feel a lot better about picketing. And there was actually a video taken of it, and a union electrician that was doing some strike support with the UFCW workers, the United Food and Commercial Workers, workers on strike at Stop and Shop. They explained how that happened. And she was able to talk Spanish with the truck driver that was a Spanish-speaking truck driver. In Worcester, for example, there was other unions involved in strike support and Teamsters not delivering stuff. And this was really, really important. And the strike I was on personally when I was younger, the Teamsters not delivering to this big General Foods plant that I worked at, and was on strike against, the not delivering flour was crucial to helping to win the strike. The Teamsters tend to have a bad rep in the corporate media because they had, and I don't have time to go into the history, but they had some rotten leadership. They still have in the national level, and back in the 60s, I guess it was, there were some very tiny amount of union leaders involved in corruption, but they were, and that hurt the reputation of the union. And but the reality is the Teamsters is a big union, and even when they have conservative leaders, they do have these traditions of solidarity, of not crossing picket lines. They often get that written into their contracts, which is really good. Now, one thing that happened is the union leadership didn't hold any meetings of rank and file workers during the strike. And there were no structures through which workers from different stores could communicate. I'm back to quoting here about effective tactics and coordinate to build for cross store action. Social Alternative, we put out a leaflet, Beat Stop and Shop, how can we win the strike? There were other supporters from other organizations and so on, the Mass Nurse Association, Mass Teacher Association, AFSCME, International Brother Electrical Workers, were involved, including people that had been on strike before. There was a mega picket that showed really you can use strike you can organize strikes in different ways, let's put it that way. A mega picket just means a really big picket targeting one store in Jamaica Plain. There might have been others as well. Or was it in South Bay? Sorry. So 250 workers and community supporters rallied in front of Jamaica Plain store, and that's prevented the store from opening during the strike. Then there was another one at, oh, there was two. That's why I got confused. There was two. One at South Bay, 150 workers, community supporters, and members of other unions, from teachers to nurses to carpenters to iron workers, gathered for a mega picket, meaning a really large picket that spanned the entire front of the massive building, covering both entrances to the store. Stop and Shop management was absolutely furious at this. We found out the next day, this is according to Elon Exelbank in this article, we found out the next day that South Bay store made 30,000 that day, but normally the day before Easter they make between 300,000 and 400,000. So these mega pickets, while only at two stores, they pointed towards what was not only necessarily to escalate the strike, a tactic to escalate the strike, but also to entirely possible achieve cross-store organizing coordination. If the unionship had called for mega pickets at stores across the region, it could have motivated more workers to join the picket line, given a concrete way for the community and other unions to support the workers, and most importantly, made it harder for the company to operate. An important lesson from the strike is, though, is that even without union leadership taking this sort of initiative, rank-and-file workers can still organize and take bold initiatives themselves. Then there's a lot in this article about the tentative agreement, including not having a ratification vote before the actual details are known, which is not good at all. You should have had release the details and allowed some time for the, you know, like 24 hours at least for the members to think about it. The new contract is better than what the company was offering before the strike. That's very clear, including stopping significant raises to health care costs that would have been dumped on the workers, cutting time and a half pay on Sundays and holidays for everybody. It does, however, cut time and a half for part-timers, who are 80% of the company's workforce, in their first 3 years. The company will use the new schedule, new part-timers on Sundays and holidays as much as possible, so as to avoid paying time and a half as much as possible. New contract does include waging raises, but they are minimal and not enough to keep up with the rapidly rising cost of living in the Northeast, including housing, food, and education. If the union leadership had better prepared workers for a strike, including setting up a public strike fund weeks earlier than they did, and used bolder tactics such as mega pickets and more rallies that included the broader public, it's very possible the strike could have won more in the same amount of time. Two-tier contracts, which corporations everywhere are trying to impose, are part of the boss's divide and conquer strategy. 3 years from now, in the next contract battle, Stop and Shop workers will try to Stop and Shop, and its parent company, multinational, will try to pit the different tiers against one another in order to weaken the union's ability to fight back. Stop and Shop workers should be clear on this and begin now to take measures to strengthen the union, fight for increased democracy, and prepare for future fights. This will take rank and file workers who agree on the need to transform the union, becoming more active and getting organized with each other across stores. So oftentimes what you're faced with as a worker, as a union, if you're a union activist as well, is that you have to organize oftentimes in ways to make the union stronger and more democratic, and oftentimes the unionship will try to get in the way of that, which makes that a struggle. And then, of course, you're struggling against management, it's tough. It's tough, but it pays off. You still have workers, union workers, making 20% more at least than non-union workers overall. That figure's remained constant since the 1930s. Also, what you need is the idea of a union going on a strike alone is absurd now, because the corporations are obviously at a point where they're coordinating at a level, they have resources at a level that are even bigger than before, and you can't take them on one union at a time. So I'm not quoting from the article here. I'm just saying that I've said this before on the show, that if you're going to have a strike, you can't limit it to one union. And apropos that earlier discussion about legality, of course, the first thing the Taft-Hartley Act gets rid of, or one of the first things that they hated, was what they termed sympathy strikes, meaning a union goes out on strike, so other unions start going out on strike in an area or wherever it does the most good to put pressure on the capitalist class as a whole and the owners as a whole to settle. So say there's a strike at General Electric, right, in Erie, Pennsylvania, where there was recently. All the CWA local in Lynn, Massachusetts, at General Electric, they go on strike as well. Not because they have a contract out, because they're in strike in solidarity with the workers in Erie, Pennsylvania. That stuff should happen all the time and more. I mean, why do you have an AFL-CIO umbrella organization? You have it so you can coordinate union work across many different regional and national unions, right? And we need that coordination to even go international. The term sympathy strike is kind of odd, so you can just forget that term. Let's call them solidarity strikes. We need to make solidarity strikes completely 110% legal. And more importantly, we just need to do them and the way as much as possible. And if they want to, haul us off to court or whatever, then we have to organize against that, because it's going to make sense to a lot of workers, a lot of working people, to say, yeah, this union went out, we agree with what they're fighting for, we're on solidarity strike with them. That makes perfect sense. And it made perfect sense, and it helped build the labor movement. And of course, it was one of the first things they tried to make illegal, and technically it is illegal, but that's one of those laws that has to be broken. We have to have solidarity strikes again in the labor movement in order to go forward. And I don't just mean Teamsters respecting picket lines. That's great. I don't just mean people from other unions going to picket lines on their own, or just the leadership. Sometimes solidarity is defined now, or has been recently, in a time period of weaker unions in the United States. Solidarity is, oh, here comes the president of such and such a local with somebody else. They're going to walk our picket line for 20 minutes and chat with us and hang our, shake our hands, and they're going to take a selfie, and that's about it. That's not solidarity. I mean, it is in a very, very rudimentary level, but it's not real solidarity where you're actually educating and mobilizing the members of one union who aren't on strike about why they should support the strike of another union, and not just support it in terms of boycotting the store or whatever it might be, boycotting the service, whatever it is, in terms of arguing to go on strike to support that union. And that sounds like a huge step, right? Because it's so out of people's consciousness now, but there was a time in the labor movement where that happened a lot, you know, and it made sense to people. Where if we fight for that, what they're fighting for, if they get their pension, then it's going to be easier for us to organize for a pension. If they get better health care, it's going to be easier for us to organize in the next contract struggle for better health care. So a lot of other stuff to talk about with that strike, and I hope that it, I've seen a lot of articles about it, and not in the corporate media since it ended, but in the alternate, you know, progressive media, some of those things that Facebook is probably shutting down now, for all I know. I don't mean that as a joke, it's sad. They're shutting down right-wing stuff, which, you know, is risky. It's risky, you know. I mean, if it's truly like a Nazi site or something, yeah, shut that down, right? But it just, that's not about Facebook taking down pages because they're negative or whatever. I mean, come on, you know, the hate speech, yes, that's really wrong. But again, how you define what hate, they didn't even say hate speech, they just say hate. Well, I hate a lot of things, and you know, hate brings justice. You know, hate motivates people to do something. I hate injustice. I hate racism. I hate capitalism, you know, and this in gives a impetus to doing something, you know. It's not just a negative thing, and there's something wrong with you if you don't hate certain things that are wrong, you know, that are hurting people in a profound way. So this, like I said, this article gets into some more stuff. Here's a good part here. A crucial measure that Social Alternative calls for in all unions is for all union officials to make the average wage for the workers they represent. Also, members should have the right to recall their union officials if they feel they're not doing their job. This would be really, really good to have in any union, but we were reminded of it in this struggle that would be a good thing to have. And then you don't have to take offense to that if you're a union leader and you're knocking yourself out. We understand. But you also got to be able to let the workers go further when they're ready to go further, or let the struggle go further when it needs to go further. And I think that was a big part of the Stop and Shop strike. So it was a victory, but it could have been more of a victory. And let's hope that if you come across articles or discussions about it, please take the time to read them and think about, go to socialalternative.org, go to socialistworld.net, read more of the articles I was quoting from, and just, you know, try to figure that stuff out a little bit. And we hope it's going to make people want to organize more into unions. And again, I don't say that lightly. It's very difficult, complicated, labor intensive, but totally worth it. And you can do it. Working people are doing it, are organizing the unions all over the country at any given moment. It takes a lot to sort of break through the sort of bias of the corporate media against working people, against unions, and register the activity that's happening all the time in the labor movement. But one statistic you should know is that the Government of Bureau of Labor Statistics keeps track of big strikes. I think it's over 1,000 workers out on strike. It might be 500, but I think it's 1,000. And so that lets out a lot of littler strikes, important strikes. But even on that basis, there were more strikes in 2018 than there were at any year since 1983 or 86. I got to double check that. I think it was 83. And that is significant because Either whether it's 83 or 86, it's those were, I remember, I'm old enough to remember, those were times where there was still a lot of union militancy and a higher consciousness and higher visibility of unions in the United States. Speaking of unions in general, New York Times had an article on July 6, 2018. This is going back to 2018, but I came across it as I was researching this and, you know, being involved in strike support for the Stop and Shop strike. Quote, fresh proof that strong unions help reduce income inequality. Now, this is written in sort of academic jargon somewhat, but like it's one of those like no kidding things, but still you want to be able to document stuff. So Susan Donarski says, quote, in this article, new evidence shows that unions played a major role in reducing income inequality in the United States in the decades when organized labor was strong. But new insights from a working paper, and this is kind of reductive because a lot of people are doing this work and tracking this stuff. But anyways, she focused on one working paper, unions and inequality over the 20th century. New evidence from survey data by four economists, Henry Farber, etc. I'm not going to list all the names. They established that unions have constrained income inequality far beyond their own membership ranks. So that's worded in a strange way, but basically it says unions have kept back income inequality or made it less worse. Not only in their own unions, but beyond into non-union workplaces. And while scholars can't, quote, pinpoint the precise mechanism at work, they speculate that unions have indirectly, this is into the non-union firms, increased pay at companies nervous that their own employees might organize. So this is like ABC to most people, but she wants to keep it in the academic format. So there was this actual study, although they didn't study this part empirically. Unions have also lobbied for higher minimum wages and pushed to hold down executive salaries, yes and yes. They have also advocated for broader access to health care, countering key channel through which income inequality can harm all of society. Now, what that's saying in a slightly convoluted way, like I mentioned, is that a lot of people are losing money, some going bankrupt, some losing their homes and so on through paying for health care costs, even if they have insurance. See that movie Sicko by Michael Moore, still hasn't gone out of, still basically the same parameters we're working under. He made a recent movie, I heard. I stopped going to see his stuff after he started supporting the Democrats again, but he made a recent movie where I think he goes revisits that some of that stuff about healthcare. According to this article again, income inequality began its steep rise in the 70s. Economists have been arguing about the origins of this trend since, with primary explanations falling into two areas. It actually falls into more than that. But basically, kind of avoids the C word, capitalism. I was going to read more than I'm going to end up doing here. But I'll just say that, let's see, I'm definitely not going to read all that stuff. Here we go. Incomes in the United States are now as unequal as they were in the 1920s. The gulf between rich and poor will widen if, and she's writing in the first person, as I fear unions are weakened further. That's very, very true. And there's a lot of data out there. Oh, by the way, that earlier statistic of pro-union polling data, public support for unions is at a 15-year high, according to Gallup surveys from the Globe. There you go. Also, I don't have time to go into this, but there was a one-day sit-in of Harvard grad students on May 1st on International Workers' Day, and they occupied University Hall at Harvard University, and they had campus-wide protests. A union for Harvard University grad students is staging, roughly 20 students, I'd probably say more than that actually, gathered inside a building at Harvard Yard. Others marched outside in support of the Harvard Graduate Students Union. Harvard administrators and union representatives have been negotiating details of an initial labor contract. So listen to that carefully. Harvard administrators, meaning managers, and union representatives from this graduate student union, were the UAW, United Auto Workers, actually, believe it or not, because the way the UAW got involved in that is they organized the first graduate students union out in UMass Amherst back in the 80s, which was a great victory. Harvard administrators and union representatives have been negotiating details of initial labor contract for the group for about a year. So, like with other, with any corporation, including universities, there is a law that says they must negotiate with a union that is, you know, goes through a National Labor Relations Board election process, which this union, this group of workers already has done. What it, the law doesn't say, of course, is that they must, not of course, but it doesn't give any time frame, and it ultimately doesn't say they have to sign a contract. So there's a lot of union organizing now where a union is successfully organized in a workplace, but management just waits out the union. Then the union doesn't feel strong enough to push, you know, for a strike or whatever. That's what it usually takes. Oftentimes takes a strike to get a union recognized. I wouldn't say often, but many times. And if that's off the table, if that's not even attempted, then and that kind of pressure isn't being brought to bear, then management catches on and basically just tries to delay things until forever, basically. They never sign a contract. And they watch the union grouping dissipate and disintegrate, basically. Even this article says that the Harvard graduate students voted last year to unionize with United Auto Workers. That would be 2018. They joined students at several other U.S. campuses that have organized since a federal panel ruled in 2016 that graduate student employees could form unions. So listen to that. There were graduate students forming unions before that, so I don't quite understand that. I guess they were breaking the law again. So we're almost out of time here. Just want to say May 1st just passed. And I, you know, we usually talk about May 1st, International Workers' Day, on the show. I really wanted to go into the Stop and Shop stuff a lot. But here we go real quickly. This is from IBW Local 11. That's International Brother Electrical Workers Local 11, the Renew Caucus they have. Renew is, means they're trying to renew the union, have it go out and do more organizing, et cetera. So they actually wrote a really good summary of May 1st. It doesn't cover everything, but it's pretty good. It says, the history matters. May Day versus Labor Day, a very brief history. Ever wonder why the U.S. celebrates Labor Day, the first Monday in September, while May 1st is recognized around the world as a workers' holiday, a day of solidarity amongst workers of all nations? The answer is bound up with the 1880s struggle for the 8-hour day, a demand of major political significance for the working class. 8 hours for work, 8 hours for rest, 8 hours for what we will, quote unquote. Already at the opening of the 19th century, workers in the United States made known their grievances against working from sunrise to sunset and then the prevailing and the then prevailing workday. 14, 16, even 18-hour days were not uncommon. In the 1820s and 1830s, there are full of strikes for a reduction of union of hours of work. Demands for a 10-hour day were put forward first. The Mechanics Union of Philadelphia led a strike of building trades workers in Philadelphia in 1827 for the 10-hour day, etc. It goes into some more history like that. The 8-hour movement, which directly gave birth to May 1st, May Day, is connected to a broad-based movement initiated in the U.S. when on August 20th, 1866, delegates from over 50 craft unions formed the National Labor Union. At its founding convention, the following resolution dealt with the shorter workday. Quote, the first and great necessity of the present to free labor of this country from capitalist slavery is the passing of a law by which 8 hours shall be the normal working day in all states in the American Union. We are resolved to put forth all our strength until this glorious result is attained. End quote. By the way, the leader of that union, William Silvis, the National Labor Union, he corresponded with Marx and was a socialist. A short time later, the First International adopted the first 8-hour day in September 1866 at the Geneva Conference. This is now international. The First Socialist International adopted the 8-hour day in September 1886. Now, let's see. The Second International in Paris, 1889, designated May 1st to be set aside as a day upon which workers of the world organized in their political parties and trade unions were to fight for the 8-hour day. The Paris decision had been influenced by events in the U.S. 3 years earlier, when there had been a call for a general strike on May 1st, 1886, for the 8-hour day. And then it goes into more history, including big May Day rallies and strikes, 11,000 marching in Detroit in 1886, 110,000 in, 90,000 in Chicago, etc. In Baltimore, remarkable for their black and white unity in the southern areas. But the event that guaranteed May Day a piece of history, a place in the history of the working class, took place 3 days later at Haymarket in Chicago. And we all, and many of our listeners probably know about that, so I'm going to give a really quick thing. That's a fight for the 8-hour day turned into a big demonstration, which turned into, depending on what you read, a police provocation bombs being thrown by the by undercover agents of the police or some sort of explosive device, and the police using this then as a excuse to go and arrest the strikers, cut across the whole movement, make everything for the eight-hour day seem suspect and illegal, and it had a temporary effect, and they hung five of the Haymarket martyrs, the workers, in November 11, 1887. But May 1st, which was already a tradition, was chosen as a day to re-inaugurate the struggle for the eight-hour day. Leaders of the AFL limited the strike movement, but May Day picked up momentum across the world, even if it lost steam here in the U.S. due to the conservative labor leaders. And this is a great quote from the article. In 1905, in a seriously punk move, the AFL disavowed May Day altogether, celebrating Labor Day, the first Monday of September, which is a national holiday sanctioned by the federal government in 1894. But May Day in the U.S. was still celebrated. In 1910, the Socialist Party brought 60,000 into the streets of New York City for May Day, including 10,000 women of the Shirt Waist Makers Union. Slowly, though, U.S. workers forgot their roots, although May Day, International Workers' Day, has come back, and there were rallies around the world, obviously, many countries having the day off. But here in the U.S., for example, teachers in South Carolina walked out for big strikes on May 1st. And there were, May Day rallies. There was one in Worcester that focused on getting union labor and conditions for the building of a new stadium there. There was the May Day rally focused also on funding for education. There was a May Day rally for immigrant rights in East Boston, as there is every year. And I have a list of places around the country, around the world, where May Day happened, as I, as happens every year. But usually there's different issues that are focused on by the May Day rally. So, for example, in France, you had the unions out doing their May Day thing, but along with the yellow vest strikers and so on, and they got viciously attacked by the police and all that. We're running out of time here, so I'm going to hit the headlines, so to speak. I could have done a whole show on Venezuela and yet another coup attempt against the government there and the horrible propaganda in the U.S. media. Fairness and accuracy in reporting went around and just empirically looked at all the news outlets, all the corporate media outlets, and not one of them is against intervention. Not one of them says no, we should not be an invasion. The Democrats, of course, even the most radical of them, are soft on the question, tending to condemn somehow Maduro or whatever when it's the sanctions of the U.S. that are really crippling the economy and the fallen oil prices and so on. Not that Maduro is blameless and not that we support Maduro with a blank check, but of course to advocate, to criticize Maduro was elected fairly, despite what they say and what the media says, and this guy Guaido has no legitimate claims to the government and is fairly unknown actually in Venezuela. That's just ridiculous for anyone to be soft on the question of whether the U.S. should invade. The U.S. should not have anything to do with invading or destabilizing Venezuela, which is what it's doing now, and it's a real crime. Now, what's different this time around is that the media isn't sticking with this story very much, and if there's, when Guaido, does like a obvious coup maneuver, it gets a 24 to 48 hour cycle going in the media here. But this destabilization is happening all the time in Venezuela now. And the pressure is very harsh on the people and on the government. But you might want to ask yourself why these coup attempts keep failing. It's because the vast majority of people have no desire to see U.S. troops or proxies for U.S. troops, meaning puppets of U.S. imperialism, basically, running the show in Venezuela. And the Chavez, when Chavez was in power, leading into the first part of Maduro's term in office, there were improvements made. Maduro actually, a lot of people don't know this, but he actually retreated, trying to appease U.S. imperialism by getting rid of some social benefits And it just made them think he was weak, and that's why they're going after him in such a big way. So we're about out of time. We had some more stuff talking about the Spanish elections. We'll have to get to it next time. And thanks for listening. And if you want to find out more about the Stop and Shop strike and more about what's going on in the local labor movement and how to organize a union even, hopefully, check out socialistalternative.org. We're going to go out with... also check out our Facebook page, Socialist Alternative Radio. We're going to go out with a song I hope you'll recognize and enjoy.
Imagine no possessions.